Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you are one of our patrons, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. And thank you to Paul Middleton, who's the most recent person I saw who has upgraded his pledge and is now getting extra message. So thank you very much, Paul, and everyone else who is supporting us.
Got a good extra message this week to enjoy.
He's got a good one that's coming out next week to enjoy.
Yes. Well, I mean, they're all good, but, you know, I was involved in the next one. So
It's true. Ian was involved in the next extra message. The first of the five that we'll have done by that point that wasn't monologued by me. So look forward to that. Everyone can support us if you wish by going to patreon.com/UK Tech. Thank you very much, patrons. Gizmodo wrote this week that Huawei is unveiling its first 5G phone for the UK next week. But, Ian, there might be a problem. Not with Huawei's phone, but the fact that the UK's 5G networks may be delayed. Now, I was covering yet another parliamentary hearing this week, but this time it was the government's culture secretary, Jeremy Wright, answering questions posed by a committee of MPs. The MPs were asking several things, but at one point they were asking about what the latest was in terms of the investigation into Huawei and the hardware it makes for phone networks. You may have heard about this. It's been all over the news for quite some time now. People are concerned that at worst, Huawei is a Chinese spy masquerading as the world's biggest maker of telecoms equipment, or at best, its products have some security holes that need patching before companies are allowed to use them here. Anyway, as part of the answering of the questions about that, Jeremy Wright said, here's a quote, "There's certainly a possibility of a delay in the process of the rollout of 5G. If you want to do 5G fastest, you do it without any consideration of security. We're not prepared to do that, so I don't exclude the possibility there will be some delay." Discussion followed around what sort of a delay we might be talking about here, and the answers were, to be honest, a little bit vague. Basically, the more equipment the government says we shouldn't be using, the longer the delay. That might all sound obvious, but this was kind of the first time we'd heard it come out in a forum like that from him. And this won't necessarily stonewall the 5G plans, of course, at least I don't think, because Huawei isn't the only company that makes 5G equipment. But it's definitely something to pay attention to, I think, because there's obviously so much attention on Huawei anyway. And this is the first time it's sort of had a possible consumer impact, right, Ian?
I suppose you could debate how much of a consumer impact it has, because we're not likely to see very much in the way of 5G for most people this year, are we? I mean, there'll be launches, but whether there'll be the sort of things that people are queuing up to pay extra for, I feel sceptical about that. The question I would raise is just exactly how worried are we about voice conversations anyway? If you want an end-to-end encrypted call, you can do it on WhatsApp or any other voice chat. I don't know, I'm assuming Discord isn't encrypted, but you know, there are plenty of ways to have an encrypted conversation if you want. There's never been easier for the public. There's also VPNs that work very simply on phones that enable you to encrypt all of that data going out. So I kind of feel like it's the kind of thing that anyone who really cares about it isn't without option. And obviously government people, anyone in a sensitive environment would be using specialist tools to make phone calls that were of a sensitive nature. Someone said on Twitter the other day to me, I'd rather it was the Americans spying on us than the Chinese. And I'm like, I don't really see the distinction. I don't feel like normal citizens should be the subject of spying, no matter what government it is, although it is a reality that it happens.
This was going to be about the delay to 5G coming to our mobile phones.
I know, but is there really going to be a delay to 5G?
Well, yes. I mean, according to Bloomberg.
Oh, well, what do they know?
Don't know. The author seemed to know his stuff.
Well, here's a thing for you, okay? Vodafone had announced, sent me an email saying that it was going to have a 5G launch and then moved it and hasn't restated when it will happen. I think we're all broadly aware that EE will launch at some point soon, although we don't know when. But I feel like it was going to be this month. So if it doesn't happen this month, then maybe that is kind of a... then maybe there is a delay. But it's difficult to know, isn't it? I mean, I don't imagine the mobile companies will be admitting it if that's the case. But do you think that they will actually tear the equipment out that they've already put into place?
Possibly, yeah. I think we'll find out the answers to a lot of this quite soon. I got the distinct impression that the report that has been completed, has been completed and will be published quite soon. So I think we will find out what the recommendation is going to be soon. But I would say let's just keep our hats on in terms of getting excited about 5G occurring as quickly as we believed it would be. I think it may be... Wow. I think it may be a few months delayed.
I'm only modestly excited about the launch anyway. I'm excited about the technology and I love hearing about it and working on it. But I'm actually indifferent to a launch because there is such little choice of hardware.
Let us know any thoughts you have on this, should you have them. Hello@techpodcast.uk. You know the score. You can tell us there. And we will keep you posted on what we hear behind the scenes, won't we, Ian?
If we get any juicy information, you're certainly right.
Oh, I'm always getting juicy information. Let's stay on the wonderfully exciting, not at all tedious topic of UK government. But don't worry. Don't worry. This is a very different type of story. And thank you, I believe, to KV in our Discord for flagging this to us a few days ago. The UK government has got on board the mobile payment bandwagon, Ian, and announced this week that it's going to start accepting Apple Pay and Google Pay for a number of transactions on its gov.uk portal. These include... You ready, Ian? Are you on the edge of your seat?
Yeah, I actually am.
Do you? Are you really?
But that's just because of the way I'm sitting. I don't know why I'm sitting like this, but I am right on the edge of it. Might change, actually. Hold on, I'm going to shuffle back.
You need better posture. I will introduce you to my yoga teacher.
Well, I tell you, I'm thinking about buying a new chair, actually.
Fascinating. So the things that are included in this are Global Entry Service. That's what enables UK citizens to get expedited entry into the United States. Basic background checks. Registered Traveller Service, which is what frequent visitors to non-EU countries, or rather visitors from non-EU countries use to get into the UK when they're using the biometric e-gate things. And then the Electronic Visa Waiver Service, which has allowed people from a few Middle East countries to travel to the UK. So if you're using any of those things, then you can now use Apple Pay on the web. On the smartphones. And I got a statement here from the Cabinet Office. Would you like to hear what it says?
Yeah, go on then.
It reads the following, Ian. Following the initial trial, it's planned to roll mobile payments across further central government services and later this year make it available for local government, police and NHS organisations. As well as being more convenient, these innovative payment types will also be more secure since they allow the use of fingerprint and facial recognition technology through users' phones. Why do you think this is interesting, Ian? I just have to guess my reason for wanting to talk about this. And don't cheat and look ahead in the script.
I mean, because government is traditionally a pain and paying for things and all of the services are just feel like they're from the 70s.
I mean, I would actually fundamentally disagree on part of that. I think some of the government's websites for applications for things, I think are actually very, very clear and nicely designed. Not all of them, certainly, but when I was doing my driver's application recently, I was pretty impressed with how fluid that whole process was.
Fair enough.
Quite pleased with that. The reason I'm intrigued and excited about this, Ian, is because I feel like this is the first step to allowing biometric authentication to be applied to more than just payments. Think about the idea of
being logging into your bank with your fingerprint ID or face ID, which you can do, but you can't do that on the government.
On the government website, yeah, or yes. for authorizing, you know, repeat prescriptions, or even passing through border security. You know,
see this as being an opportunity for us to use our biometrics on our phones as a more broad authentication thing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and John has actually touched on a point more coherently than I think I would have explained, which is about voting. Imagine if you had your face registered, or, you know, fingerprint registered or whatever, and you were able to vote electronically using, you know, biometrics. Like this is a long step down the road, but it's the reason that I'm excited by this.
I'm not. Tom Scott on YouTube has a really good video about why electronic voting is and always will be a disaster.
It seems to be working quite well for Estonia.
Well, you can say that if you want, but I watched the video. It's really interesting. It really, really is.
I don't watch videos from anyone who has two first names as a first name and or a surname.
I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing you've ever said. But I would encourage you to do so because the pencil and paper method is about as uninterferable with as is possible for it to be. Anytime you introduce computers, it's a big problem.
What about the counting with the human hand?
I don't know. Seems to work. People wouldn't tolerate it if, you know, the candidates themselves would not tolerate any opportunity for miscounting and that kind of thing. You get recounts all the time. It's no point me re-parroting everything he said, and I can't remember it all anyway, but I would encourage you to watch it.
Can we just step into the utopia of my mind for just a moment? Because this is all about the excitement of what if it would work and was okay. Yeah. It's a hypothetical positive thinking here. And that's why I like this, because this is putting payments, technology, biometrics at the forefront of paying for things with government. And that is a step that can only be pointed towards using like biometrics and smartphones for more things. If it works, I think it would be pretty game-changing.
No, I mean, I'm happy to live in this utopia. I think that there are a lot of things, like you said. I think I'm probably more interested in repeat prescriptions and stuff like that, because a lot of the government services have a government gateway ID at the moment, don't they? And it isn't a very good system.
No, in fact, there was a report this week that it's called Verify. And it was published and criticized as being a massive failure. And I actually knew that this was a massive failure. And I'm annoyed about this because I was going to write a story, because I was speaking to Margot James, MP, and who else was I speaking to? One of the shadow MPs, about proposals to make a much, much better standardized identity system for British citizens. And I think I could have had this story if I'd have pushed it that a little longer. It's a bit of inside baseball for you all, but yeah. That annoyed me.
Well, the other thing that I'm thinking about when it comes to this this topic is, do I really want the government being able to build up a more complete picture of me? Do I want government all the government services to be linked to one another, and for that to be, you know, something? Because if you lose control of that for some reason, and we each only have, you know, one set of fingerprints and one face, if you somehow lose control of that, and I don't know why that would happen, but it could, then that's a real problem. Like, someone could access literally everything about you. You know, the government can see everything about what you do from every sort of disparate service. I'll give you an example. I mean, the TV license isn't a government thing, but, if that was part of it, if it was, you know, part of a sign-in process, then they'd know about that. Anything that where you have to register and use that biometric data could be something they would build up a picture about you that I'm not comfortable with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it does, yes. Like a massive spike on a Ferris wheel, it's a fair point. and actually, Luke pointed out something interesting in the chat as well, which is that having any kind of electronic voting also means there's a possibility that your vote won't always be completely anonymous, which is, a very fair point.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, vote anonymity is is guaranteed pretty much by the pencil and paper system. I noticed that John said that there's plenty of paper-based rigging, and absolutely, but that tends to be from inherently corrupt dictatorships and governments, rather than, I mean, not saying that ours is perfect, but I do feel like in this country there is a relatively solid back history of, you know, reliable paper voting.
According, Ian, to a write-up on Friday by the Birmingham Mail, eBay is going to open its first concept store, offering small businesses the chance to sell their products. So hold that criticism for just a moment. Rob Hattrall, who's the vice president of eBay in the UK, told the paper, the small retailers taking part in Wolverhampton's retail revival have already shown that physical and online retail can survive and thrive together. Now, you may be asking, why are we talking about a little store that's running for a month in the Midlands by eBay? And it's because it was a very, very slow news week. Almost almost so slow in terms of UK tech news with a consumer angle that I almost considered not even doing a show this week. So that's why we're talking about the Midlands. It has come to that. Not that there's anything wrong with the Midlands, just that this is a small story. But I have been using eBay quite a bit recently, Ian. And so this did excite me a little bit more than I initially thought. But I know that you did a mid monologue moan there.
I did. I mean, so I'm really bored. I'm really bored of companies setting up concept stores. And I'm particularly bored of the idea that eBay, an online auction site, is considering it. I mean, I suppose I can see it if there's enough local businesses that use eBay, but why? There's the internet.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because eBay was an online version of a thing that happened in a physical location, and now this is a store version of an online version of a thing that happened in a store. Well, not always a store, but you know, an auction house.
Well, you know, or an auction house or whatever. But it's not just eBay. I roll my eyes when Samsung creates a concept store, or OnePlus, or anyone. Like, if you're going to do retail, opening one concept store in one city is just, it just seems pointless. And I mean, this is obviously a very small part of a bigger picture. eBay already has deals with places like Argos, I think, where you can buy something on eBay and it will be delivered to your local Argos, meaning that you can pick it up when it's convenient to you rather than having to wait for it to arrive in the post whenever it feels like it. I kind of get what they're saying, but I also don't see why it's eBay that is going to be responsible for this. You know, wouldn't it be better if there was some sort of coalition of local small businesses which there almost certainly is, which would, you know, have a store that's the same kind of idea? Or if we just approach the problem head on, which is that a lot of small businesses can't afford high street rents and rates, and that's actually the real issue. It's not, the high street isn't dying because there aren't people that want, you know, because there's a lack of interest in people selling things, because there is, you know, bespoke design and manufacture in every town and city in the UK. It's just that these things are unaffordable and it's getting worse.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't actually thought about that. The idea that, yes, it's something that eBay could afford the real estate and allow people who can't the ability to sell through it.
Yeah,
which is
fine.
It's a little bit like what a market is, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
it doesn't really address the issue, does it? It means that eBay then has control over a high street, perhaps, or, you know, we become reliant on bigger companies like Amazon doing the same thing and saying, oh, look, you know, we've got, there's a load of people in Manchester who use Amazon for these very bespoke things. Why don't we invite them all into our Amazon branded store? And, you know, you can pick up your Amazon packages and all that kind of stuff. And there's a selection of local wares. But it's just like, but then all it's doing is turning over the high street to big business. And then when they get bored or they can't make a profit out of it, they just give up and go away again. And then that's it. You've got, you know, the high street is effectively then dead because those companies have pushed up the rents, pushed, you know, the rates are already unaffordable. I was listening to a radio program about it, you know, and it's a shame because there are viable businesses that can't afford to be on the high street that would like to be. And the high streets are dying because the only people that can afford the rents and rates are vape shops and coffee houses and charity shops and stuff like that. And it's making the high street a bit rubbish. And then it's just big business and the same thing over and over again. And every local high street looks the same and no one wants to go to them because, you know, we can buy all that mainstream stuff easily over the internet.
That's why I like a lot of the stores around Shoreditch in London. Is you get a lot of oddments around there, like the Box Park, for anyone who's been around there.
And most cities have something like that. You know, I've been to places in Manchester that are like that. I'm absolutely certain there's some part of Birmingham where there's this kind of opportunity. You know, and it's great, and I would encourage it, but at the same time, I still worry that the problem isn't being solved by this and action is needed.
Yeah, the chat room's talking a lot about the prominence of vape shops. Pangolin Sandwich mentioned that. And
it's
Nick.
Really interesting because, I mean, I don't know about the business behind vape shops, but I mean, I live in a relatively, I mean, I live near Surbiton, but that's not exactly where I live. And looking around this area, there are so many vape shops. It's actually staggering. And they all seem to be staying in business for more than a few months. So there must be real profit to be made.
I don't know. Yeah, I've thought that. But every time I walk past them, firstly, I never see anyone in any of them. And secondly, it's always just some lonely guy. And it is, for some reason, seems to always be men standing behind the counter just looking at the phone. It looks like the most depressing little hellhole.
In a cloud of vape.
In a cloud of vape.
Yeah,
probably.
Because you can vape in vape shops, obviously.
It's just horrible. But, you know, I was reminded, just then, about a complaint that I once made in a blog post years ago. This is what a fascinating episode this week's show is. about Camden.
Because yes.
I remember walking up Camden as I do less often these days, sadly, but I used to be there very frequently. And I walked past one shop that sold, like, novelty snow globes. And then, you know, next to that, there was another shop that sold novelty snow globes and maybe some leather belts. And then a couple of stores down, there was a shop that sold novelty snow globes and so forth. And I counted, I think there's like 12 different shops up that single street. It's not a massive street, that all had snow globes or snow globe-like paraphernalia within, like, the first bit of entrance in there. And my first thought was, how can there possibly be a need for this many bloody snow globe retail stores on a single street? But then another bit of my brain fired up and said, well, they've also been in business for years. So whatever the ridiculous appearance of all these shops is, they obviously make money because they're still in business. And it's probably not cheap to have shop space in a very high foot trafficked part of London.
That's the thing, isn't it? They're tourist shops aimed at a relatively touristy part of London. They aren't shops that serve the local community especially well, but there is enough footfall from people keen to see Camden. I mean, Camden's a great area. It has a lot going for it, those shops largely excluded. But there are obviously lots of places to go and eat and some good pubs and stuff like that. So it has a relatively high amount of tourists, you know, walking through it. Plus, London Zoo is just around the corner, isn't it? So,
It is. Nick Gassman in the chat room has pointed out a link to a BBC radio programme behind the facades of World of Business. He's asking if that was the show that you listened to.
That might well have been the show. There was a. I remember there was a bit about about suits. It was a suit company that was struggling, and they had, I think, a retail position somewhere that was quite far off the beaten track, but they were unable to afford, I think it was something like £40,000 a year in rent alone. But they were like, well, obviously we would love to be on the high street because, you know, it means that people will see us and they'll, you know, we'll have some passing trade. Whereas if you're, you know, you could be the best suit company in the world, but if no one's heard of you, then you ain't going to sell any suits.
Word of mouth, mate. That's what it's all down to, isn't it?
Well, of course, but that's a slow process, isn't it? It requires that someone finds your shop for the first time, and then that they tell their friends, and that their friends are buying enough of what you sell to make it worthwhile. But, you know, yeah.
Well, I have a request for anybody in Wolverhampton or who fancies going there. The shop is apparently open now. I'm on expressandstar.com, and there's a story that has photographs from this store. So if anyone fancies going and checking it out, maybe doing a little audio report, do feel free to, well, do that and then send it to us, and we'll listen to it. And if it's good, we'll put it in the show. Diving into the mailbag here, we've had some really encouraging feedback. I've been very humbled and encouraged by the feedback that we've been getting to Extra Message, our new sister show on for patrons. We put one out a couple of weeks ago now that was looking at sort of preserving memories and conversations and things for posterity. I'd said that, you know, I'd recorded my grandma shortly, you know, before she died, about sort of hearing some of her life story in her words, but without telling her. Raphael wrote in and said, I really enjoyed your Extra Message on recording your family members' interactions for posterity. Still, I think that doing that without telling them would be rude. So I asked my father if he wanted to record his life story, but he didn't, alone or in conversation with me.
The only thing he wanted, very much like my dad, that.
The only thing he wanted to do was talk to me one-on-one. So we made lots of walks, only the two of us, and it was the nicest thing ever because it was done with a purpose. And he points out that he and I achieved the same thing but did it in two different ways. And I think that's great. You know, as a journalist, I'm always very mindful of the ethical nature of recording people without them knowing because, you know, a journalist should only ever tell people, you know, ask them if they mind your recording.
Yes,
you know, every single person I interview, you do that. But I think that on this, for something like this, for me, the sort of the slight ethics was massively outweighed by knowing that I would have a very perfectly natural conversation for years and years and years to come. And I just felt that was more valuable to me than the slight ethical question mark was.
As soon as you introduce the concept of it being recorded, I think people who aren't used to being recorded then immediately switch into a mode that's quite hard to get good stuff out of them. It's not impossible, but I think it requires hours and hours of recording to get them into it, and you have to get them to agree to it. And I know my dad probably wouldn't, but I have thought about this quite a bit. You know, I think, you know, everyone alive has such a wonderful range of stories to tell, and probably 90% of them have not been told. I'm thinking about my own life, and, you know, I mean, obviously I would struggle to remember bits of it, but, you know, we did Extra Message, didn't we, talking about the
I was going to use that as a preview afterwards.
Well, all right, that's fine. But we talked about memories, didn't we?
Yeah,
you know, it was relying on our memories, and a lot of people won't know any of those stories. So, it's easy to see the value of it. So, I don't know. I completely agree that you shouldn't do things without people's permission, but I can also completely understand people who do, because it's harmless. We're not talking about publishing these things, are we? We're talking about having a memory that's really only relevant to us anyway.
Well, I'm glad that the email from Raphael provoked a conversation in its own right. So that was really good. Pangolin Sandwich, actually, in the chat says, we filmed my nan and granddad talking one Christmas and didn't tell them, and now she's not with us. It's one of the few videos I do have of her. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, this is why I think it's valuable. So thank you, Raphael, for listening to Extra Message and also for commenting. We've got an episode that, as Ian sort of hinted at just now, coming up next week that we recorded already, where we're going to take you back in time to 2007, when Ian and I first started podcasting together in a basement at CNET. You're going to hear a lot of interesting stories about the early days of our podcasting. You're going to hear about, what else we talk, Rory Reed's Monitor Punch segment. We're going to talk about the phone gnome. There's a lot of fun stuff there that I pretty much guarantee no one will have heard before. And we had a lot of fun doing that. So
we did.
Yeah, so that's coming up. You can get in on that if you wish to join us as a patron, patreon.com/UK Tech. You can access all the extra messages straight away, of course. Anyway, text message keeps you informed about our British tech landscape. But let's get into Tom Merritt. Came out horrifically. Let's get into a segment within which Tom Merritt is going to explain what's been happening in the wider world of technology over the last week.
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week on Daily Tech News Show, all the cool AI announcements from Microsoft Build, some cool AI announcements and privacy efforts from Google I.O., why some apps might make you think crime is rising when it's not, one more voice asked for Facebook to be broken up and why his solution wouldn't help what he thinks the problem is, and Patrick Dorton explains why a brand new $3,000 laptop might not work as well as your current one, even though your processor is supposedly slower. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you again to our patrons. It's great to have you with us and supporting us and getting extra message and so forth. patreon.com/UK Tech.
We'd also love to hear from you if you'd like to email us. The address is hello@techpodcast.uk. You can follow us on Twitter. It's @textmessagepod. We post all of the biggest British news stories and some from around the world so that people can keep up with the news just by following our Twitter feed, and those obviously inform the show that week. If you've got a spare minute, you can review us on iTunes. That's the best way of supporting us without spending a penny.
It surely is, my friend. It surely is. Right, I'm off. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.